Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and assistant editor, Hannah Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Stephen Gange, who will discuss some of the data on the UroLift system, which was presented at the American Urological Association annual meeting in Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Gange is a urologist at Summit Urology Group in Salt Lake City, Utah, as well as an associate medical director for Teleflex. So Dr. Gange, before we move into some of the work that was presented at AUA, could you just start out by highlighting the landscape of BPH, including some of the recent advances in that space?
Yeah, sure. We have observed a remarkable increase in minimally invasive treatment options, starting really with UroLift in 2013 with the FDA approval. And it's just been almost exploding since that time. Now, there are some other things that aren't minimally invasive that are also very interesting, like Aquablation. But to be honest, everybody is gravitating. And I don't mean every doctor, but certainly every patient has an interest in being exposed and available to have things that are less painful and less cumbersome, fewer side effects, and ideally can be performed in an outpatient setting with minimal anesthesia. And that's really what UroLift has sort of established as the new frontier and maybe the new standard as well.
Great. Well, thank you for that background. Could you also speak more to what the UroLift system is and how it became a treatment option for men with BPH?
Right, so UroLift was actually invented in 2004 by some brilliant mechanical engineers and then started its evolution, if you will, through the early trials in Australia and finally came to the United States in 2011. So when it became available in the U.S. under clinical trials settings, we all appreciated its simplicity and its elegance at the same time. It's an implant delivered by a device which contains a curved needle, and the curved needle delivers the outermost aspect of the implant, and then with the tensioning suture, an innermost metallic implant is also applied. And this can be performed rather quickly and very tolerably, even in a purely local anesthetic environment. So there have been some questions over time that have arisen, such as, you know, who are the best candidates for this procedure. And that has actually expanded over time. So in our clinical trial that I participated in, the LIFT trial in 2011, we were treating men who had prostates 30 to 80 cc's. And since that time, with additional evidence derived from our real world studies, that upper limit has gone to 100 cc's. In addition to that, we've learned how to treat middle lobes, and also patients who had radiation and patients in retention. So the expansion of opportunity for patients has been remarkable, and it's really owed to the diligence of ongoing clinical investigation brought forth by Teleflex.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that for us. Kind of moving into the work that was presented on the UroLift system, could you discuss some of the results that were presented at the AUA meeting this year?
We've also had some controversy about what represents failure and what represents a complication from these procedures. And we finally have some really nice objective comparative data based upon Medicare and commercial claims. And so it's not just the potential for, if you will, bias in a clinical trial looking at one methodology. Now we've compared UroLift, Rezūm, Greenlight Laser, TURP, and Aquablation in a claims-based evaluation, and interestingly found that UroLift sort of led the way with the least complications, again, based on this objective claims data. So I think that's fascinating. I think it helps kind of quiet the buzz that maybe these procedures are maybe more complicated or tend to fail more often. And with regards to failure, the fact is that in a study that was performed with Klaus Rehrborn as the principal investigator, we now have a sense for what might increase or decrease durability of a UroLift implant. And it's shown that, the size of the prostate, the onset of the actual intervention can really have an impact, and also the numbers of implants deployed. In the United States, we're limited by what's called an MUE, a medical unlikely edit, to 7 implants. And it seems that when given the opportunity, maybe 7 ought to be deployed. And that's again from this pooled analysis of over 300 subjects, and really all the studies that many of the studies I've been involved in. And so there's a lot of satisfaction in sort of seeing the cumulative effect of those studies and some retreatment information that's come from it. And then finally, the question has been raised, should we treat men in retention? And we have had good evidence with this Pulsar study performed in the UK. We also had good evidence from our real-world retention data, and the combination of the two were presented. And what we see is that the size of the prostate and the onset of treatment have indicators or become indicators for the likely success of the treatment of a man in retention, and also the degree of retention. So a man who has a lower amount of retention versus one who's retention volume is double that amount is going to have and this may be intuitive, but is going to have a likelihood of a greater response. So I guess like my summary statement about all of this is it's nice to get some objective measures and some better data surrounding these things that we already believe in. We love the low complication rate of UroLift. We like knowing that the sooner we treat our patients, the better they will do. And I think, there's been this push towards earlier intervention. And when we have minimally invasive therapies, earlier intervention is really a practical consideration. Patients drag their feet on more involved therapies, but when we do something in the office that takes a matter of minutes with a quick recovery period, patients will in fact come to those therapies sooner. Really, now the trick is to get our primary care colleagues to send them sooner, because some of the problems that we've run into is that they don't quite know what to do and they don't have evaluation tools. And so they hang on to these patients until such time that they're seriously, severely symptomatic, maybe even to the point of catheter dependency. And even though we can treat those catheter dependent men, we'd certainly like to treat them sooner.
Great, yeah, thank you for discussing that data. What would you say are some of the implications of these findings for both patients and urologists?
I think urologists can appreciate that the versatility of UroLift is continuing to expand, and that we can very successfully treat men in retention. And although these studies don't specifically point to it, we know about middle lobes, we know post-radiation patients, and the safety associated with that treatment. And from a patient's standpoint, although they're not reading these papers, they're going to learn from their urologists who have confidence in these minimally invasive therapies that there's not a lot of reason to drag their feet. And quite honestly, the sooner we're treating these men, the better they do. So I think those are sort of the take-home points for me. I continue to be, very confident in UroLift as a standalone entity, and the claims-based data really kind of reinforces that. Also, the retreatments that do occur with UroLift, I think if we define retreatment by, surgical intervention, UroLift does very well, even competitive with TURP. So those are again kind of the take-homes for me, is that urologists may continue to gravitate towards UroLift, and patients have already shown that this is something that they prefer.
And then, kind of looking into the future, could you speak to any further research that might be planned on these topics?
Well, I think that the research is going to be procedural. We haven't seen a new BPH drug in quite some time. I think we've all begun to appreciate the toxicity of these medications and the failure rate from these medications. It almost seems like an unnecessary placeholder. I think many of us now believe that therapies like UroLift, minimally invasive therapies in particular, can be a first line therapy. So I think we'll continue to see, and I know of several in clinical trials, we'll continue to see the emergence of other missed therapies. And I think we'll also see the application of some of this data, allowing for earlier intervention and more precise intervention. So yeah, I think we're in a really good space with BPH. It took us a lot of years to get here. We muddled through microwave therapy and other radiofrequency applications. Heat seems not to work very well. Now we have these procedural devices that that are very intriguing and are well tolerated and seem to do a really nice job in the long run. So I continue to think that's where we're heading. But I don't think the creativity has ended. And even in companies like Teleflex, I see developments of UroLift or spin-offs of UroLift coming down the trail, and it's pretty interesting altogether.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Dr. Gange. And again, we really appreciate you taking the time to discuss these results with us.
Thank you very much, Hannah. And I'm very happy for the opportunity to talk with you and to deliver some of this information.
You just heard an exclusive interview with Dr. Gange on some of the UroLift data presented at AUA. Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by visiting our website, urologytimes.com, or by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Urology Times. Thank you for listening.